Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Just a brief program note before we continue. For those of you who heard our messaging in recent days pointing to today as a one-day pledge drive that was originally scheduled for today, nobody wants to do that now. So we are postponing that fundraiser for now. We'll get back to it at some point, but obviously that would be inappropriate and nobody wants to do it anyway. So that one-day fundraiser scheduled for today has been postponed. Now, Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut is in the news for doing something U.S. senators rarely do, and many even less. He cried on the Senate floor yesterday. He said a lot of things during that speech, too, that people are finding helpful, even if sad or infuriating to hear. So with the luxury of being able to play extended excerpts on this show, not just newscast sound bites, we're going to play a minute and 45 seconds of Senator Murphy, who, of course, is local to our area and who lived through the Newtown, Connecticut, Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in his state and has made this a core issue ever since. Senator Chris Murphy.
Sandy Hook will never, ever be the same. This community in Texas will never, ever be the same. Why? Why are we here? If not to try to make sure that fewer schools and fewer communities go through what Sandy Hook has gone through, what Uvalde is going through. Our heart is breaking for these families. Every ounce of love and thoughts and prayers we can send, we are sending. But I'm here on this floor to beg, to literally get down on my hands and knees and beg my colleagues. Find a path forward here. Work with us to find a way to pass laws that make this less likely. I understand my Republican colleagues will not agree to everything that I may support, but there is a common denominator that we can find. There is a place where we can achieve agreement that may not guarantee that America never, ever again sees a mass shooting, that may not overnight cut in half the number of murders that happen in America. It will not solve the problem of American violence by itself. But by doing something, we at least stop sending this quiet message of endorsement to these killers whose brains are breaking, who see the highest levels of government doing nothing, shooting after shooting.
Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut on the Senate floor yesterday. Gave us some stats at the beginning of the program. Here's another stat. All 12 of the deadliest mass shootings in U.S. history have happened since 1999. And of those 12, half of them happened in just two states. You want to guess which ones? If you guess Texas and Florida, you're right. Six of the 12 worst mass shootings in the U.S. in terms of lives lost happened in just those two states, Florida and Texas. We know and we are seeing again that when a mass shooting like this happens, politicians in Washington tend to run to their corners and then nothing happens. After that tearful plea, getting down on his knees, begging, it's basically the rhetoric he was using, from Senator Murphy, on some conservative media outlets, they were just criticizing him for trying to politicize a tragedy or politicize a tragedy too soon. So nothing seems to happen in Washington, even though he says there are common denominators, he said in that clip, on some of the things. And we'll talk about whether there are a little bit. But a lot does happen at the state level, as it turns out. And with us now is UCLA professor Christopher Poliquin, who has an article on theconversation.com with a look at what happens politically at the state level after high-profile gun events. And some of this may surprise you, what actually happens in different states. He did a study on this with some co-authors from Harvard. Professor Poliquin, thanks for some time today, and I know it's very early where you are on the West Coast, so double thanks and welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
You looked at a 25-year period from 1990 to 2014. What questions were you looking to answer?
Well, we were really puzzled by, you know, after all of these mass shootings, there's all this attention put on Congress. You know, is Congress going to act? Are they going to change policy? And yet, one of the things about gun policy in the United States is a lot of the policy decisions are actually made at the state level. And so we were really curious, you know, despite all of this attention on Congress, whether policies would change at the state level in response to mass shootings. And so we assembled this database, as you say, covering 25 years, looking at state-level legislation, bills that are getting introduced. There were about 20,000 of them over that 25-year period, and looking at what kind of policies these state legislatures enact after mass shootings. And what we find is that big increases in the number of bills related to guns that get introduced into state legislatures. But really interestingly, the primary effect in terms of the laws that actually get enacted seems to be Republican-controlled state legislatures loosening restrictions on firearms after mass shootings.
And that's the reveal, right? Much of the Republican response to the Uvalde, Texas shooting in the last day has been to focus on hardening the schools as targets. We're actually going to do a separate segment on that later, including having an armed guard at every school and train teachers with guns if they want to arm themselves. But at the state level, loosening gun restrictions in red states, some tightening of them in blue states. What's an example? What's the most common example, if there is one, of how Republican-controlled states react at the legislative level to big public gun events?
Yeah, well, really what you see, I think, in terms of policy proposals from Republicans is ways to get more firearms in the hands of kind of the so-called good guys. We saw this kind of yesterday right after the shooting, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton saying, well, we need to arm teachers. By the way, it's worth noting that after the Santa Fe High School shooting in Texas in 2018, Governor Greg Abbott actually did sign a bill into law that made it easier to arm teachers in Texas schools. Now, a lot of schools haven't, you know, taken Texas up on that offer. But I think, you know, arming teachers, we've seen that happen in Florida after the Parkland shooting, in Texas after the Santa Fe shooting. It's clearly something that Republicans are talking about again after this last shooting yesterday.
Overall, you did find more legislative activity on guns after mass shootings, even though they account for fewer deaths than individual shootings. Can you tell us more about that pattern and why you think it is?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, if you were thinking kind of from sort of like a rational policymaking standpoint, you know, I don't know that mass shootings would be where you would put the bulk of your attention when it comes to gun violence, because they represent such a small share, you know, think roughly kind of maybe 1% of all gun deaths in the United States. And so if you were kind of thinking about policies to reduce gun violence, you would want to look, you know, much more broadly than just at mass shootings. But in this study, we kind of looked at how, you know, changes in the ordinary murder rate affect policy versus changes in policy that stem from mass shootings. And, you know, I mean, these numbers are a little bit imprecise, but what we kind of see is that, you know, you should think about it taking about maybe 125 ordinary gun murders to kind of have the same effect that a mass shooting has on bill introductions in state legislatures. And we think a lot of that has to do with the fact that mass shootings are just incredibly salient. They get an enormous amount of media coverage relative to the more day-to-day gun violence that, you know, that plagues the United States.
Yeah, although I guess maybe up to a point, because gun violence of more the individual kind is the big issue where I am in New York City right now. And some of these individual murders of one person at a time, like an 11-year-old girl in the Bronx the other day, like a 48-year-old guy just riding the subway into Manhattan from Brooklyn. On Sunday, there was a random shooting of him, apparently. Guy just walked onto the train and picked out somebody to shoot and then got off the train. And, you know, this is the big issue now in New York City, where the public is pretty galvanized around this issue in a way that I think is usually more reminiscent of something that goes on in the country for a period of time after mass shootings. So maybe there's something about this period that we're in that makes it a little different. I don't know.
It could be. And certainly from the pandemic, studies have kind of been looking at, you know, how the pandemic affected gun violence. And one of the things we've seen is huge increases in gun sales beginning in spring of 2020. And then, you know, recently, you know, just enormous increases in gun violence, as you're saying, kind of the ordinary day-to-day type of gun violence. Now, whether the increase in gun sales is causally related to the increase in gun violence, I don't think research has necessarily fully established that. But certainly there has been a dramatic uptick in gun violence recently, and so people are paying attention.
All right. Now, listeners, we're up to the politics. We spent the first part of the show just identifying and expressing sympathy with the people of Uvalde, Texas, with our first guest who is from down there. Now we have Chris Poliquin, who has an article on theconversation.com. He's from UCLA, and he's done this study on what happens politically at the state level, since almost nothing ever happens in Washington after high-profile gun events. He found more than 3,200 gun laws passed at the state level pertaining to guns in the 25 years that he studied, from 1990 to 2014. That's so many law changes for just 50 states, but they tend to loosen gun laws in Republican-controlled states as well as tighten them in some Democratic-controlled states. So now, listeners, you can weigh in on the politics of this or anything else you want to say, and we'll go to Michael in Manhattan. Michael, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi, I love your show, and I listen to it practically every morning. I wanted to tell a story about how when I was 23 years old and dating a police officer, who had taken me to the firing range and taught me how to use it properly and understanding how to load it, unload it, etc. How one day when I was at home alone, for some reason, I was curious and took his guns out from where he kept them. And I thought I had emptied the ammunition, mm-hmm. and I was pointing it at my head. And I guess, you know, even as an adult, it is an object of fascination. And then I said, but be on the safe side and never point it at anybody. And I fired the gun into the floor. And I was never so terrified in my life.
And still to this day.
Yes, I will not touch a gun. And any man I date who owns one, I run from. And I was an adult. And I just think if I could do that, what happens with children, you know? If they just shouldn't be around. And I was thinking to myself, you know, when it comes to issues like abortion and gun control, if the majority of the populace is on the side of sense, why can't we have referendums and let the general public decide, especially when these are such hot issues, rather than letting it be decided by politicians who are beholden to different groups? I mean, we have to figure out how to take back the power because politicians are, you know, in office because we've legalized bribery by certain groups, and they're, you know, I mean, you know what I'm saying.
I know what you're saying, and I think we all know what you're saying. And Michael, thank you for saying it and saying it so eloquently.
Thank you for listening and taking this call.
Professor Poliquin, you do mention in your article that public opinion polls reveal extensive support nationally for several gun control policies, including background checks for gun buyers and a ban on assault weapons. Maybe those were the basic things that Senator Murphy was referring to in that clip as the common denominators that people can all agree around. You're not really a political science professor, even though you've been looking into this particular area in the ways that you have. But do you have any data to support what the caller was just saying at the end of her call there, that we hear so often, that it's the gun lobbies, it's the special interests, it's not even the constituents of these senators and maybe House members who won't do anything about guns, because public opinion is actually not all that divided on some of these basic gun reform measures, let's say just background checks and assault weapons bans. But it's something other than public opinion in our democracy that they're even responding to?
Well, you know, certainly the gun lobby, especially the National Rifle Association, is, you know, extremely well organized historically to kind of push for looser gun legislation. You know, on this point about public opinion, you're right to highlight universal background checks. It's one of the policies that Republicans and Democrats see, you know, quite eye to eye on. Polling from Pew suggests that that and restrictions around people with mental health issues getting guns are quite popular with both Democrats and Republicans. And after the Sandy Hook shooting, right, we saw the Manchin-Toomey bill come, you know, quite close, maybe as close as any policy has kind of come after a mass shooting in Congress of passing. Now, on this question about, you know, whether constituents, you know, do or don't want something like an assault weapons ban, you know, I think it's interesting, again, to look at the states, because while certainly a lot of people say, well, I would support an assault weapons ban, I'd support maybe more rigorous permitting standards, a lot of those people are actually already living in states that have those strict policies, right? New York, California, Connecticut, Maryland, Hawaii, all of these states have assault weapons bans already. And one of the issues for a Republican senator in Congress, when they're thinking about maybe voting on one of these assault weapons bans or another policy, is that doing so might put them out of step with the constituents in their home state. So if you look at the states that are controlled by Republicans at the state level, none of them have assault weapons bans. Presumably one of the reasons for that is that in those particular states, that policy would not be especially popular. And of course, if you're thinking like a senator, you also have to realize that, you know, to get elected, you don't not only have to win a general election, you have to win a primary, right? And so to the extent that Republicans try to kind of cross the aisle and find common ground with Democrats, that might not only put them out of step with their general constituency in their home state, but it might certainly put them out of step with the Republican primary voting constituency in their home states.
Keith in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Keith.
Hey, how are you, Brian?
I'm all right under the circumstances. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call. I love your show. I actually, you took my call many years ago on a different topic, a much happier topic. But I wanted to ask you if you have an update on whether Governor Abbott and actually Senator Cruz are still going to attend the NRA annual convention in Houston. I understand from the news that John Cornyn, the other senator from Texas, is not going to attend due to quote-unquote personal reasons. And I think, you know, I would ask if Governor Abbott was going to attend, what would he say to this organization after he, you know, had a quote, which was, quote unquote, talking about the killer, he shot and killed horrifically, incomprehensibly 14 students and killed a teacher. I take issue with the word incomprehensibly. It's absolutely comprehensible when you arm people and let them buy guns on their 18th birthday. It's not incomprehensible at all, Governor Abbott. So what is he going to say if, in fact, he is going to attend that NRA National Convention.
Yeah, well, let's see. I'm looking at a Houston Chronicle story. This is now from last night, so I don't know if it's changed. But the headline here is Trump, Cruz, Abbott still set to speak at NRA meeting in Houston. So that's as of then. Here's one from 42 minutes ago in the Washington Post. Headline, Trump to speak at NRA meeting in Texas days after school shooting. And by way of context, it says the Memorial Day weekend event is the year's largest for the gun lobby, meeting after cancellations due to the coronavirus pandemic. It's set to take place over 3 days and, quote, showcase over 14 acres of the latest guns and gear, unquote, according to the official website. So Cruz, Abbott, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, Representative Dan Crenshaw of Texas, North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, all Republicans, Senator John Cornyn, this article in the Washington Post confirms, was scheduled to speak but pulled out before the shooting. This says before the shooting for personal reasons. So that's from the Washington Post 42 minutes ago. So I guess they're all still going to speak, Keith, in answer to your most direct question.
But I mean, what do you think Governor Abbott is going to say, you know, or these other folks from the state of Texas to this organization? I mean, it's almost the gun barrel is so hot, you know,
yeah,
this mass shooting.
I guess we'll find out. Keith, thank you very much. Professor Poliquin, do you have any indication of that? I mean, from your study of how politicians reacted to mass shootings over a 25-year period, would you predict anything in particular in terms of what all those politicians will say when they speak to the NRA's largest convention of the year this weekend in Texas?
Well, I think you're going to hear them say that more guns would make us safer. And, you know, I don't think that they say that kind of cynically. I think that this really does reflect, to some extent, some deep philosophical differences between the two political parties, where Republicans, especially some of these politicians, right, that Keith is mentioning, Ted Cruz, Greg Abbott, really, I think they really do, to some extent, believe that having more guns in circulation would reduce this kind of violence. Now, there's not a ton of evidence for that, but I think that that's a honestly held belief that they have, and I would expect them to echo those beliefs in the coming weeks.
And this is WNYC, FM, HD, and AM New York, WNJT, FM, 88.1 Trenton, WNJP, 88.5 Sussex, WNJY, 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO, 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio and live streaming at WNYC.org. A few more minutes with Professor Christopher Poliquin from UCLA, who has studied political reactions to mass shootings since 1990, or for a period beginning in 1990. And Lynn in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lynn. Thank you for calling in.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I don't know what federal government mandate there is for all the states to have to issue driver's licenses. But, you know, the Second Amendment calls for a well-regulated militia. I'm not going to get into the term militia, but the regulations for driving cars, which are just meant to get people from one place to another, exist. There really are none for guns, many anyway. You know, you've got to take a test to get a license to drive the car. You've got to study for it. You've got to get car insurance. You have to have your car registered by the state. The states establish their own rules for issuing driver's licenses, but you have to have one. And it boggles my mind. Nobody complains about that. But a gun whose only purpose is either to maim or murder other people, well, maybe hunting, possibly, but mm-hmm. You don't need to, you're not, there are no regulations for them. And I don't really understand it, and I don't know what can be done. And just a second thing, as I was listening to other people speak, I'm a recently retired public school teacher, and the idea of arming public school teachers is insane. First of all, teachers would have to have those guns locked and the ammunition someplace else in the classroom so the kids wouldn't get them. By the time anybody managed to find the key to unlock the gun and load it, it would be useless. I mean, it's just stupid. It's stupid thinking. Teachers are not sharpshooters, period. But anyway, I'm sort of curious about the regulations and the licensing issue.
And we'll talk about that. I'm curious for you and on the thing you just said as a retired school teacher. If you think there are best practices, this is actually going to be our next segment in a little while. If there are best practices for while there is such a saturation of guns in our country, to, in the meantime, defend the school, even while people are working to change the laws and change the prevalence. You know, what we're going to hear a clip later from the Republican Attorney General of Texas, who was complaining on TV last night that there was no armed guard at the school. He thinks there should be armed guards at every school, if not also armed teachers, like you were saying. And I'm just curious if you as a teacher, because certainly this is not new. Columbine was 1999 and there were school shootings before Columbine in those several years just before that. Well, must have had a thought about security. So do you have any thoughts about best practices?
Yeah. I mean, I teach in Brooklyn and we had very, very, first of all, the city mandated that all external doors to the school have to be locked. The main entrance was open so that people could come in and out. There was a security guard there. The guards were never armed. There's an intercom system or like a phone system where with codes so that if somebody managed to get in past the security guard, the principal or somebody would make an announcement, an innocuous announcement that was a clue for all the teachers to go and lock their classroom doors. So, and we could do we have shelter-ins, lockdowns, you know, there's a stranger, an intruder in the building, and we practiced these. And the kids, it was done in such a way that the kids were never made to get scared. But we practiced this over and over again, and the doors are heavy, they were locked. Nobody could get in. We had to hide the kids. We hide them, but you've got to do precautionary things. I think more guns in the school is just mayhem and madness. You've got people shooting, and who knows who's shooting who at some point. Yeah. It's just not the way to go.
Lynn, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. And Professor Poliquin, she made enough good points there that we could discuss them for the next hour without bringing on any guests or any other callers. And, of course, we don't have time for that. But let's touch on a couple of things that she did bring up. One, on the arming of teachers, which is a Republican talking point, and that was going to be the main point or one of the main points of the gun legislation that the Trump administration was trying to get through Congress. And that was, again, to, I guess, provide federal funding to back up training for individual teachers who wanted to get armed and do that. So has that push resulted in anything? That was after Parkland, right? Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, that shooting in Florida. Big push on the right to arm more teachers. Do you know if that has gone anywhere?
Yeah, so there are schools in Florida. There are schools in Texas that do arm teachers. I think, you know, teachers groups have been somewhat resistant to this for a lot of the reasons that Lynn is saying, right? That how are you going to have the teachers always have the guns on them? Are they going to be locked? You know, FBI research on active shooter incidents shows that, you know, most of these incidents are over within, you know, 2 to 5 minutes and already, because law enforcement is already trained to respond. And so, you know, how exactly introducing kind of armed teachers into the situation is going to help isn't, you know, super obvious. I would say that they're, given the nascency of some of these policies in Texas and Florida to arm teachers, I would say that we don't have a ton of good research or evidence either way on this on yet.
Yeah. And on her other main point at the beginning of her call about how the Second Amendment refers to a well-regulated militia, we know the Supreme Court a few years ago in the Heller decision really affirmed that it's an individual right to own arms. It's not just if you're training to be in a militia at a time when there's no standing army, which was, you know, I think the original constitutional context. So, okay, the Supreme Court says there is an individual right, not just a militia context. But what about the words well-regulated? And I know you're not a constitutional law professor, but Lynn makes the great point, and it came up in an earlier segment too, that you don't need training to own a firearm legally like you do to own a car or drive a car legally, when the point of a car is not to kill. The point of a gun is to kill, even if you're just, you know, training yourself to use it in self-defense for worthy, virtuous purposes. The law, I guess my question for you is, as you've looked at all these states and state laws, how many state laws require any kind of training before somebody can be licensed to own a gun?
So I don't have the exact numbers for you on training, but to this point about kind of well-regulated that Lynn was raising, you know, a lot of states do have quite extensive gun regulations. This is a really big divide between blue and red states, where in states like Massachusetts, for example, it's going to take about 30 days for you to get a permit to carry a handgun. In a lot of states, you can't go out and buy an assault weapon. Here in California, you need a background check just to buy ammunition, right? And so there actually are a lot of states that extensively regulate firearms. And so a lot of us are already living in states that have these policies that, you know, a lot of us would like to see enacted nationally. Of course, there's also a lot of states, the flip side of this is that there's a lot of states that make it extremely easy to carry weapons. One of the trends in recent years has been Republican states making it possible to carry a concealed firearm without any permit at all. There's now, you know, maybe about a dozen states that have that policy. And we've also seen a lot of states enact stand your ground laws, and research shows that those are not effective at reducing gun violence. In fact, just the opposite. And so, you know, I think when it comes to well-regulated, you really have to make this distinction between states, because the policies vary widely.
And we're waiting for a Supreme Court decision any day, which might push Texas's concealed carry law, that is, making it relatively easy for people with legal guns to carry them in public, to impose Texas's standard on New York, which does not allow public carrying of guns as readily. And that might be the next right that somebody has, which is to carry a gun on your person based on the law of the state you live in or got it licensed in or bought it in, rather than under the law of the state that you're in at the time. We're waiting any day now to see what the Supreme Court says about that. So we will leave this part of the conversation here. We will leave it here with Chris Poliquin, who teaches strategy at UCLA, but has done this deep dive study on gun laws at the state level from 1990 on. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.